Hello and welcome to The Menu on Monocle 24. I am Marcus Hippi. This week we look ahead to the following 12 months in the hospitality industry and find some reasons for optimism.
Whatever's happening in the world outside, you're having a lovely meal and a glass of wine, and it's that kind of restorative benefit of restaurants. And I think, to me, that's our USP as an industry. It's looking after people and giving them a great time.
Then it's January anyway, so we hear how a new premium non-alcoholic spirit from Scotland is making waves in the UK and beyond.
If we can create a really confident alternative, then you're leveling the playing field and allowing people to make a choice, the best choice for themselves.
All that plus the week's top headlines and a dinner soundtrack recommendation ahead on this edition of The Menu here on Monocle 24. We start the first episode of this year with a look ahead to what the year 2022 may bring for the hospitality industry. Adam Hyman is a regular guest on Monocle 24. He's a restaurant consultant and founder of Code Hospitality. He joined Monocle's Tom Edwards to discuss what lies ahead for the hospitality industry and what he has planned for 2022 himself.
Unfortunately, we are still in the kind of COVID headlines, aren't we? I mean, look, it's been a very, very tough 2 years for hospitality for obvious reasons, with no socialising. You know, that's a big part of why we go out to restaurants, bars, and obviously with no travel, it's obviously really impacted hotels. I think we are starting to see the beginning of the end. The UK government have now dropped the pre-flight lateral flow test to come back into the UK, and they've now changed it from a PCR to a lateral flow for the day two when you arrive back to the UK. They may seem like quite small things, but actually there's a huge boost to hospitality, both for business and tourism, because it put people off travelling for a long time and we need people to get back onto planes and come and visit the cities around the world. With restaurants in the UK before Christmas, there was this kind of phrase going around saying it was basically lockdown by stealth. People weren't actually being told what to do, but the whole sentiment was around be very careful, don't ruin Christmas. And obviously, you know, naturally humans go, I'm going to be cautious and I'm not actually going to go to the pub or to a restaurant before Christmas because I don't want to ruin it. And that was really devastating for the hospitality businesses up and down the country. We need to put our best foot forward, which we are doing. January, February, March are very quiet months for the hospitality industry, especially in the UK, but also kind of globally. It's known as the quieter times. On the flip side, in a way, that helps because staffing has been a real problem. But obviously, you know, we need people to be coming into hospitality venues to spend money because they need to keep going. In the UK especially, March sees a lot of the financial support that the government have given us coming to an end. So I think it's, you know, we're still not out of the kind of choppy waters yet. We're going to have to do a lot of work in rebuilding not only hospitality as an industry and, you know, showcasing to people that it is a great industry to work in. But, you know, there's a lot of businesses, sadly, that I still think may go under before the end of March just because they've not made enough money and they've not had enough custom. However, I think the fact that hopefully this is the beginning of the end, we are starting to see people, yes, okay, we're going to have to test. And I think, what's the phrase, flow before you go is going to become more of a normality. But, you know, I was in Devon, down in the southwest of the UK over Christmas, and restaurants and pubs were all heaving. So I think that, you know, we have seen that shift in people's mindsets that 2 years ago, people were scared to go to restaurants. There was all this talk about, you know, having to have plastic divides between tables and one-way systems and, you know, all the outdoor dining. And I think we've definitely moved on from that, but it's still going to be challenging.
And I wonder, as part of the sort of reset button that we can hit, is there a point, we've had this conversation here at Monocle about how, you know, in the media landscape, the cream has risen somewhat over the last 2 years. It's been very straitened times, hugely challenging, and the best have been even more innovative and even more progressive in terms of the decisions that they've been making. Do you think that as we look at trends for 22, we will see that? So we'll see people who are more innovative, more progressive, maybe in the opportunities they offer, the way they navigate other unprecedented challenges. Look at the supply chain issues. I'm sure that's still a big issue across, yeah, well, globally across the hospitality sector. So we'll see new innovations. I mean, is that another thing that makes this an exciting time, Adam? Are there conversations you have with people you work with, for example, and who come to you for your expertise, and they say, look, you know, there's going to be new trends, more innovations, and actually it's quite exciting?
Yeah, it is. I mean, a great example over the past couple of years has been meal kits. Yes, okay, the demand for them is probably not going to be quite as intense as it was over the 2 years when you couldn't actually visit a restaurant. But I think that just shows, you know, in the space of a very short time, you saw restaurateurs essentially become retailers. And there are a lot of these businesses that will keep doing that. And I think that's such a good example of innovating. And it was a lifeline for a huge number of restaurants up and down the country and around the world. I think for me, the beauty of hospitality is, you know, we're so dominated by tech and everything moving so quickly that I think the real kind of beauty of the industry and what we can offer is that moment of you sit in a restaurant. Yes, QR codes have had their benefits, but actually you put your phone down, you sit opposite someone or even by yourself, and you have that 30 minutes, an hour, however long, of breaking bread, having conversation, and you almost kind of forget about the world outside. And I almost think, especially over the past couple of years, you can really see the demand for that. And, you know, talking to restaurateurs, especially to build up over kind of Christmas, and they actually struggled to keep up with the demand because of the fact that they had staffing issues and supply chain issues. And I think, yes, we can evolve and we can innovate, and there's elements of tech that hospitality can get better at. But I think the real beauty of it lies down into that kind of, it's that human touch almost, that you sit down and you're looked after and you're given a nice time, and whatever's happening in the world outside, you're having a lovely meal and a glass of wine. And it's that kind of restorative benefit of restaurants. And I think, to me, that's our USP as an industry. It's looking after people and giving them a great time.
Let's have some fun then with 22. We said we could be at a bit of an inflection point. Maybe things are taking a turn for the better, finally. And I don't want to tempt provenance at all, Adam, but give us a few of your kind of, I don't know, wish list items then for 22. Presumably it is that the opening up continues, that we don't lose any more great restaurants or great people from the business, whether they're front of house or behind the scenes. But give us a couple of thoughts of things you hope to see or you're looking forward to as 22 continues.
Yeah, I mean, obviously we very much hope that everything starts to open up again and people can travel. And I think that's one of the great joys of traveling, is going to try different food around the world. I think the one issue that we really need to tackle here in the UK is this issue around no-shows. And I think as an industry, we need to get better at that. And we're probably one of the only industries in the world now where you, in theory, could make 5 bookings for dinner tonight and only show up to one of them and not really get penalised. And yes, okay, going out to dinner should be kind of spontaneous and fun, and we don't want to make it too much of an ordeal. But I think we really need to try and educate the customer more on going, look, totally fine if you can't make your reservation tonight or tomorrow or whatever, but just tell the restaurant, because it hits manners and polite, but it makes such a difference knowing that that maitre d' can then sell that table because there aren't people coming in tonight. So I'd really love if we could find a way as an industry just to collaborate better and say, like, how are we going to deal with this? I think we're going to definitely see a lot more around sustainability and the topic around vegan food. It can be quite a Marmite topic, vegan food, but I thought it was very interesting to see Daniel Hume of 11 Madison Park in New York. You know, he had a restaurant in Claridge's called Davies and Brook, which sadly closed at the end of last year on the 31st of December. It was their last service. And it closed because Daniel, you know, he'd made 11 Madison Park vegan. I think it was kind of halfway through last year, and he wanted to do the same at Davies and Brook in London. And the hotel, Claridge's, couldn't quite agree with it, which I understand as well for their clientele, you know, and he decided to part ways with them. And, you know, huge respect to him as a chef. And I think we are going to see more of that, not so much as a lifestyle, because I think, you know, saying vegan food is healthy is not correct, but I think just along more of the sustainability lines, and whether it's that more restaurants focus on kind of flexitarianism. But I think just as a world, we are more educated and I think care more about that. Okay, well, you should only be eating certain foods when they're in season. And actually, you know, should my vegetables or fruit that are stocked on my local supermarket shelves, should I be eating them if they've been flown halfway around the world? And actually, they're only really grown in this country in these times. And I do feel that actually, you know, lockdown and what we've been going through over the past few years with COVID has actually reinforced that kind of issue around people eating local food and actually shopping locally and supporting their independence as opposed to just these kind of large supermarket chains. So I do feel we're going to see more of that. I don't think it's going to happen overnight. But, you know, you can see very small things like McDonald's launched their McPlant burger. And actually, dare I say, McDonald's are the ones who are probably going to actually change the way people eat. Because, you know, you can have these great Michelin star chefs doing it, but obviously it's only a very small percentage of the population who can go and afford to eat there. But actually, you're kind of, you know, $1.99 McPlant burger. If you can actually get those in front of the general population and they go, do you know what? It tastes just like a normal burger, very happy with it, but, you know, it's actually saving the planet a bit more and it's doing a better thing, then that's where I think that can be very powerful, putting it in front of the masses, so to speak.
And Adam, what about business or structural trends? Obviously, so much of the preoccupation is going to be making sure you are staffed and competitive and doing what you're doing. But are there any smaller trends? I don't know, you know, we have sort of the food truck moment, or you talked about restaurateurs turning retailers. Anything you're already kind of seeing or hearing about, 22 things people are thinking about in terms of structural dynamics or shifts? Or is it just about hopefully getting back to these sort of inverted commas traditional values of great hospitality, service, etc.?
Yeah, I think you're going to see people wanting to do more experiential stuff, and whether that's travel or whether that's sitting down in a restaurant. And there's kind of, you know, you saw there was quite a lot of stuff last year focused around live entertainment in restaurants. And I think that will continue to happen and will be a thing. But yeah, I think, you know, over the next kind of 12 to 18 months, especially in the UK, it's going to be focused on kind of staffing, how we get staff. You know, obviously the impact of Brexit and COVID has made it very difficult for restaurants to hire staff. So I think, yeah, there'll be a strong focus on that over the next 12 to 18 months. And you're actually starting to see quite a lot of fine dining in that kind of new wave of kind of new luxury, where it's not stuffy, but actually you don't get any choice. And you're starting to see certain chefs going, this is the food I'm serving you, and if you don't want to eat that or you don't like it, I'm sorry, but actually this is what I'm serving you and this is what you're going to eat. So maybe we'll start to see more of that.
Adam Hyman of Code Bulletin there, speaking to Monocle's Tom Edwards. Let's next continue with this week's food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Paige Reynolds.
Thanks, Marcus. A diplomatic spat has spilled over into the realm of alcohol as Taiwan's government has reportedly bought 20,400 bottles of Lithuanian rum bound for China. Taiwan Tobacco and Liquor, a state-owned company, said it stepped in to make the purchase after learning the shipment was going to be blocked by Chinese authorities. The Chinese government has been punishing Lithuania by blocking trade after Vilnius allowed Taiwan to be used in the name of Taipei's de facto embassy. Next up to Germany, where a debate has erupted after the country's new agriculture minister stated that the price of food should reflect the ecological truth. Cem Özdemir has said he wants to see more organic and less convenience food in Germany, and that meat should no longer be sold at bargain prices. Critics condemned how this places a higher burden on poor people, and that the minister has missed this point in his statement that sometimes I get the feeling that a good engine oil is more important to us than a good salad oil. Elsewhere, the race is on for wine connoisseurs to acquire some of the world's great vintages, as there are concerns that climate change could lead to some disappearing forever. Experts have warned that the issue will continue to drive sales of famous wines, which rose by 15% in 2021. Changing weather patterns are becoming a key consideration in investment decisions about wine, and give yet another reason for solutions to be found to fight back against the climate crisis. And finally, new figures from the United Nations show that global food prices declined from a near-record high at the end of last year. Prices have surged after harvest setbacks, high freight rates, labour shortages and the impact of the energy crisis on supply chains. The recent numbers offer some welcome respite to consumers and governments facing the pressures of inflation and provide some hope for a better 2022. That's all for this week. Back to you, Marcus.
Thanks, Paige. You are listening to The Menu on Monocle 24. To celebrate this January, when many of us try to cut alcohol, we next learn about a new alcohol-free drink hailing from Scotland. Fera Gaia claims to be Scotland's first distilled alcohol-free spirit, distilled from 14 land and sea botanicals and blended and bottled in the Scottish lowlands. Fera Gaia is now available across the UK, in Canada and Australia. The company was founded only in 2019, and in recent months it has got some new significant financial backing, making the future very exciting for the brand. To learn more about Fera Gaia, its ethos and plans for the future, I spoke to the company's co-founder, Jamie Wild. He began by explaining how the idea for the spirit was born.
Back in 2018, my co-founder, Bill, and I got together. He was working in America, working with some great brands and introducing premium spirits, whiskeys, gins, etc., to East Coast and also Southern states. And I was back in the UK, which is where I am now. And we caught up sort of on an annual basis when he was back in town. And we ended up having a sort of quite a fateful discussion really about the trends that were emerging in drinks in general, and also how we were feeling in our careers in terms of how we see the road stretching out in front of us. So Bill, being Scottish, has always sort of been inspired by whiskey and the rich heritage of whiskey in Scotland. So we were discussing areas around that. But I think what really took over was, at that time, Dry January was really taking hold, which is a movement based in the UK, started from the UK, which, you know, it's a time of year where people look at alternatives to alcohol and they try and abstain. And that was a sort of movement that was picking up. I think maybe a million or so people were doing it back then. And we saw out of that a great deal of brands, bigger brands, mostly beers, tackling or trying to launch and launching these different expressions that were alcohol free. And I think that got us talking and that got us thinking. And when you pair that, the idea of the rich heritage of the history of Scotland with premium spirits, with that idea of, you know, an alcohol-free drink, I think there's some ties across that. How can you build real confidence into alcohol-free, which we felt from our experiences in our respective businesses, we felt that there was still some ground to cover in terms of actually bringing a true, authentic alcohol-free drink to the market that could really change people's habits. And that was the moment that we sort of thought, actually, you know, this is something that we could look into, and this is definitely something that we can get excited about. So things evolved from there. And within 3 or 4 months, we had both left our jobs. Bill had come back from America and we got the ball rolling. And yeah, it's been quite a journey since then.
Did you know what you were putting yourself into back in 2018? How clear of an idea did you have of what you wanted to create, what the name of this drink would be, what it should taste and how it should be made?
I think really not a great deal, because the process of making alcohol-free spirits is quite an unfounded one. There isn't a real rule book around it. And, you know, we found that a lot of the alcohol-free drinks are very reliant on alcohol. They either contain alcohol or they're using alcohol in the process or mimicking the taste of alcohol. And so the one thing that we knew that we wanted to do was to actually make a confident alcohol-free drink. So it didn't need to rely on alcohol, which we just thought was, I mean, that's basic in terms of just clarity and making sure that you can create a confident drink. And the second thing that we're both agreed on was we both grew up, fortunately, by the sea and also just having access to the outdoors. Bill was brought up in Scotland and I was brought up in Cornwall in the west of the UK. So we had both had that love for connecting to bigger parts of nature, landscapes, sea, and getting out into that. We felt that there was a good bit of crossover in terms of how can you really evoke this sort of connection and escape to a truly alcohol-free product. And so at that stage, that's really what we had as a bearing. We had a true sort of goal to want to make it alcohol-free and a drink in its own right without being reliant on alcohol. And then we also had that real sort of draw to Ferragaya, which is a direct translation, means wild earth. And that's really where we're looking to reconnect drinkers to in their mind's eye as they sip and enjoy a Ferragaya drink.
How long did it take for you to get the recipe right and the manufacturing method right?
Well, as I said before, there's no real rule book in alcohol-free distillation. And so we had to break a lot of ground and develop our own process. We actually spent 7 or 8 months making the alcohol-free spirit Ferragaya on a rotovat, which is a very small distillation device. It allows you to be able to experiment with all the different botanicals, and it's a very effective way of being able to sort of understand the flavor. And so we found after 7 months really of development that we had a product that we really liked. And what we wanted to try and achieve was a layered depth to the flavor, because a lot of the alcohol-free alternatives were either quite sweet or floral, herbaceous. It's like we wanted character and we wanted something that was quite a unique expression. And so we found that and we took that into the distillery and tried to scale it up, and it just didn't work at all. And so all of this work that we put into this development of the product was pretty much sort of ripped up, and we had to start again from scratch and rebuild it. So that was a very stressful time. And thankfully, through some really good advice from some key people and some hard work and belief, we managed to crack what is Ferragar today and develop a process that is small batch, but we can make more than 5 litres at a time, which is what our glass ceiling was with a small rotovap in the lab that we were working with at the time.
And now you have indeed created Scotland's first distilled alcohol-free spirit. How do you drink it? What's your favourite way?
My favourite way of drinking it when at home is I love it with tonic and a slice of orange. Very refreshing. It's got a nice herbaceous complexity to it. And it's just got a very unique, recognisable flavour that obviously I'm very biased, but it sort of very much owns its own space. You can't really compare it to anything else. So as a go-to when at home, that's what I drink. But when I've worked with some fantastic bartenders up and down the country, and indeed now overseas as well, which is very exciting, I've tried many different cocktails with Ferragar, and my favourite is the smoky old-fashioned, which has a little bit of ginger syrup, Lapsang Souchong tea, which has a great sort of smokiness, which complements the sort of the depth of flavour of Ferragar very well. And it's just a fantastic drink, and you really sit back and can really savour and enjoy by yourself or with a group of friends.
Excellent. So at the moment, Ferragar can be found across the UK and also from a few other countries. Tell us.
Yeah, so we're in about, well, we're almost at 400 points of distribution in the UK, and they fall into premium independent retailers and also some really leading great sort of hospitality venues. And we're also looking overseas. We see great potential in having a product that is developed and proud to be from Scotland. Provenance is very important for us, and we found that there's a great appetite internationally for Ferragar and for the proposition. So we're live in 4 international markets at the moment, which include Canada, Australia, Spain, and Denmark. And we've got a couple of exciting new market launches coming in the next 4 to 6 weeks. And so it's a very exciting time as we scale up and we look to the future.
And there's also been some very exciting news just in recent months. You have just secured some rather substantial financial backing.
Yes, which is a huge moment for us. And having set out on what is quite a risky venture as a proposition, and you have great ambitions and dreams that this product can grow and build into something one day, to get the backing we did and to secure the funding is a huge vote of confidence in what we've created. And it's very, very exciting to be able to be here now and looking ahead, you know, with the same amount of ambition as I had before, but there's a means of being able to execute some really, really exciting activity. And 2022 is going to be a real year of transition for us. And, you know, I see it as the sort of the real true beginning. The last couple of years has been proving concept, launching the product, learning about it, making it as good as it can be. And now it's time to put the foot down and show what we can do.
How much can you tell me about the plans you have for the future?
I can definitely dip into quite a bit of it. We've got exciting plans with a team. We're a small team at the moment. We're a team of 3. So we're investing in expanding the capacity in the team. So that would be great to get the energy and experience into Ferragar. Also looking at how we can extend the distribution in the UK and also internationally. That's going to be really key for us and build on what we've done to date. And there's certainly a lot of opportunities as the drinking habits evolve and the awareness of alcohol-free spirits and alcohol alternatives evolves as well. Our online store is very important. And so how can we make the customer service as good as it possibly can be and build some real brand loyalty through the activities that we do? And to that point, in terms of the experiences that we offer in the partnerships, we've got a very sort of purpose-led vision with Ferragar, which is linked to Wild Earth, of course, which is the meaning of Ferragar. So we've done some great partnerships in the past with seaweed cultivators and various different rewilding outfits. So that's sort of the purpose-led activity that we're going to be doing to really show that we are a brand that's going to not only deliver a great product that is of great quality with great provenance, it's also something that has real purpose. And so I think consumers these days want to have a great product, but also want to be sure that the company and the organization they're backing is acting in their best interests. And so that's very much our ambition and the vision that we have for the future of Ferragar.
Jamie, just finally, I'd like to hear your thoughts about how people's drinking habits are changing. There's been a lot of talk about people drinking less alcohol, but is this something that's going to continue for a long term, or Are we going to be just drinking more again when it's 2030 or 2040?
I don't think I would be in the space if I thought that the trends would be going back to the habits of old in 2030. I think Bill and I still drink, and we don't necessarily push sort of teetotalism, because I believe that people should have the power to make their own choice. And our feeling is that if we can create a really confident alternative, then you're leveling the playing field and allowing people to make a choice, the best choice for themselves. And to that, I believe that people are looking at moderating alcohol, and the trends and the insights all support that data. I think lockdown was a big year, certainly from my experience in the UK. I think we saw obviously habits change very drastically and routines change. And a lot of people looked at alcohol alternatives because they didn't have the same pressures or the same intensity of calendar activity that they normally would. And they found that actually alcohol-free alternatives can really sort of hit the spot at the end of the day, and alcohol isn't required. So I think a lot happened last year. I think people coming out of lockdown has probably meant that everyone's had a good time and maybe been drinking a little bit more than they were the year before. But I think over the next few years, you can expect to see the alcohol-free become more popular. People certainly sort of understanding what alcohol-free drinks are good ones. And so I think there's going to be a lot of development in the market, and there's going to be a lot of competition. And I think ultimately there's going to be some fantastic brands and drinks that come out of that. And Veragaia will be one of them, I hope.
Jamie Wild, co-founder of Veragaia there. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday if you're listening in Los Angeles. Meanwhile, do check out our menu spin-off show Food Neighbourhoods for great recipes. This show was co-produced by Charlie Filmacourt and Sophie Monaghan Coombs, and edited and mixed by David Stevens. I am Marcus Hippie. Once again, we finish this programme with a dinner soundtrack recommendation. Here is Kylie Minogue with Dancing. Thanks for listening.